drive more slowly. It might mean encouraging people to work from home indeed, but it might also ultimately lead to rationing in a few months' time.
Oh, rationing. Okay, well, thank you so much. That was Adam Bell, partner at Stonehaven. We have a little bit of time, and I have with me the dynamic duo of Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
What are you going to ask us?
We can now settle a vicious rumour that's going round. Now,
Trevor, I
completely understand this, right? I do this programme by myself.
Yes.
And I hate myself most of the time.
Oh, do you?
How do you two actually get on? Off microphone.
Well, because it's quite good fun working with you, mate.
It is
so
possible.
It's also one of the oldest tropes in the book to try and set two women against each other.
Don't fall for it, Trevor.
Let's watch them fall out with hair pulling.
This has nothing to do with gender. This is to do with...
It's everything to do with it. Everything.
No. It's to do with who's got more of the microphone.
No.
I don't want Hugo Rifkin in here taking my time.
Well, that's because you're male and an egomaniac.
Okay, that's it from me today. I'll be back at 1 p.m. tomorrow. Next up on Times Radio, it's the loving duo of Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Pertinence of the man. Good afternoon. It is 2 o'clock. This is Jane Garvey and her dear friend, Fee Glover, on Times Radio until four.
I don't think we want to start that rumour that we're part of a loving duo.
No, that was a little hard to hear.
Coming up on the show today, spend less on welfare and more on defence. That's the call from the ex-NATO boss who wrote the government's strategic defence review. We're going to ask the pollster Luke Trill what the public reaction would be if that happened. Scientists make a major advance in understanding the genes that cause neurodevelopmental disorders worldwide. We're going to talk to the Sunday Times' own James Coney about what that means for families, including his. Our big interview after 3:30 is with the news presenter Tom Bradby on his new book Red Scorpion, and Sade and Iron Maiden are amongst the British acts entering the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Do you agree with their inclusion? Has someone been missed out?
Here's the news at 2, James Kitchen.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. New forecasts reveal Britain will sustain the largest hit to growth from the Middle East war and suffer the joint highest inflation in the G7. The International Monetary Fund warns stagflation is set to plague the UK economy yet again. Times Radio's newsroom reporter Ollie Cole has the details.
The IMF says the conflict could plunge the world into the largest energy crisis in modern times if all sides continue to escalate. The surge in oil and gas prices since the first strikes on Iran will hit growth in the UK hard and propel inflation to double the Bank of England's target. The IMF warned that growth would be 0.5 percentage points slower relative to its January forecast at 0.8% this year. Inflation is on track to average 3.2% in 2026 and head towards 4%, the joint highest rate of price growth with the US in the G7.
It comes as Sir Keir Starmer and Emmanuel Macron prepare to co-host a summit in Paris on Friday to examine ways of reopening the Strait of Hormuz. The French president says he wants to promote a peaceful multinational mission aimed at restoring freedom of navigation, insisting it will be strictly defensive. Meanwhile, at least two ships, including a Chinese-linked tanker, have crossed the strait, challenging a US blockade. Beijing has condemned the move, an American move, as dangerous and irresponsible, warning it will only exacerbate tensions. US Vice President J.D. Vance has accused Iran of economic terrorism, saying two can play at that game after the regime closed the shipping lane. Farzin Adimi is senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Speaking to Times Radio, he said Tehran has little room for manoeuvrability.
The door is still open. I think the contacts are still on. And at some level, the discussions will continue. It could or could not be another round of negotiations anytime soon. But I think that at the end of the day, the Iranian regime will not show any willingness or ability to show the flexibility that the US administration desires.
The Prime Minister and the Chancellor are being accused of complacency on defence by the author of the government's own review. In a speech later, the former NATO chief, Lord Robertson, will warn the UK's underprepared and not safe, adding Britain's national security is in peril. Funding for the Defence Investment Plan appears to be holding up its release. The former Labour Defence Secretary, Lord Hutton, told Times Radio ministers need to step up.
We hear great speeches from them, but words don't equip armies. Words don't give the Navy more ships and the Air Force more aircraft. We need money and resources and a commitment from the government to start spending now. And that's just not been forthcoming. And I think this really has to change.
Bridget Phillipson's ordered the Equality Regulator to tone down its guidance over single-sex spaces and make it more inclusive before she presents it to Parliament. The Women and Equalities Minister hasn't yet published the long-delayed new code of practice. A Supreme Court ruling in April last year defined gender as relating to biological sex. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Hello. It's all gone off now, hasn't it?
It's all kicked off.
What's this from Nick? Maybe you two could recreate the Dynasty mud wrestling fight between Linda Evans and Joan Collins, but do it on the radio.
I think it'd work.
Only if I'm Linda. Absolutely no way.
Oh, gosh. I know. I don't mind being Joan.
You don't
mind
being Joan?
No, I don't mind at all.
Didn't you meet Joan once?
I did. Yeah, we didn't get on.
No, that's right. Good story, that. You'll have to listen to the podcast. I'm sure we can isolate the episode in which that anecdote is trotted out. Right. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover. We're here until 4 o'clock. 0333 003 2353. A packed show as ever. Today, what are you willing to sacrifice in order to pay for increased defence spending? Pornography showing non-fatal strangulation is going to be banned. Spider bite hospital admissions are up. We're paging our resident GP, Dr. Rachel Ward, a little bit later. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, the British stars are really muscling in. And what's this suggestion from Simon? Chumbawamba should be on there.
Really? Simon, are you being serious?
No, I don't think so. Oh,
oh my God.
How does he do that so quickly?
So, Simon, the problem is, yeah, that will be an earworm for a very long time for everybody now.
And there's been another hair-pulling incident in football. So, look, we've got everything covered between now and 4 o'clock. The big guest after 3.30 is
Tom Bradby. So we probably know him first and foremost as the anchor of News at 10 over on the ITV network. But he is also a novelist in, well, it's not really his spare time. It's definitely a dual career now. And his latest book, it's a spy thriller. It's called Red Scorpion, Father, Soldier, Drug Baron. Which one would you trust? He is in to talk about that. But he's also been on lots of very interesting beats over his career. He's been Ireland correspondent, Asia correspondent, political correspondent and royal correspondent. And he asked that question of Meghan when she was on her first royal tour after giving birth to their son. He said, "How are you doing?" And she said, "Well, I'm glad you asked me that because nobody else has asked me." And a can was opened at that point. So we will definitely talk about that with him.
Interesting. And Harry and Meghan have gone on tour.
To Australia.
Yeah. So if you've if you're listening in that part of the world and you've encountered them, let us know all about it. We love hearing from you. 0333 003 2353. What are the most read stories on the Times website?
So far today, in at number 3, Katy Perry accused of sexual assault by Ruby Rose. The actress claims that Perry assaulted her at a nightclub almost 20 years ago. Perry denies the accusations, calling them dangerous, reckless lies. The second most read story, father took own life after botched dental treatment in Turkey. This is Pavel Bukovsky, who travelled to have his teeth replaced with implants, but was told he would not have temporary dentures, which destroyed his self-confidence. And the most read piece on the Times website, Iran war latest, our live page. China-linked tanker challenges US blockade of Strait of Hormuz. The vessel joined another in crossing the waterway. Beijing has criticised what it calls President Trump's dangerous and irresponsible action around Iranian ports. You can read all of those articles any time of day. You can go back into the archive if you've got your digital subscription. If you don't have one, get one. You can do that very simply by going to thetimes.com/subscribe. Would you like some gloomy news?
Yes, please.
Right, well, news breaking in the last couple of minutes. The IMF says the UK will face lower growth and higher inflation than any of the other G7 countries. This is because of the war in the Middle East. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, responded by saying the costs of the conflict are not the ones the government wanted, but it will have to respond. That all happening as Downing Street faces renewed calls to prioritise defence spending. Now, the man who led the UK's Strategic Defence Review, Lord Robertson, accuses Labour of displaying a corrosive complacency towards military spending. He also says the expanding welfare budget is making it impossible to defend the nation. Here is Times Radio Breakfast host Stig Abel, one of the hosts, I should say, putting that point to Health Minister Karen Smith on Times Radio Breakfast this morning.
Over time, we will be reducing that welfare budget for people who should be in work, particularly young people, not in employment, in training. And I've seen some great schemes, again, in my constituency. Also, my constituents and people across the country absolutely want to feel safe. That's why we made that commitment to increase the defence budget. That is why we are increasing the defence budget. That is why that George Robinson was working with us to have that strategic defence plan. All of that we did immediately in coming into office. That was our commitment before coming into office, because we knew that this was a perilous situation. And I think what we've seen in our response is exactly the right response to the situation we inherited.
Well, that's the voice of the Health Minister, Karen Smith, talking to Stig Abel on the Times Radio Breakfast Show this morning. And straight in from you, Ian, who says, I am a pensioner, I'm in Chelmsford. If we're going to increase defence spending, we could freeze benefit and pension increases for 3 years. So there you go. There's somebody who is prepared to make a sacrifice. Max Hastings writes on this subject in the Times today, saying that like previous generations, we must make financial sacrifices to ensure we are properly defended. But how would people actually react if they were asked to make those sacrifices? Let's talk to Luke Trill, pollster, UK director at More in Common. Luke, what is your response to those calls from Lord Robertson and from Max Hastings?
Well, look, I mean, there is no doubt that the public are worried about both the state of the world. In fact, over 8 in 10 think that the world is more dangerous than when they were growing up. And they're also worried about our ability to defend ourselves. In fact, in some polling that we did over the weekend, we found that across a range of different threats, from cyber attacks right through to a ground invasion, the public thought that it was more likely than not that we wouldn't be able to defend ourselves. So this is very much top of the public's mind. They are worried that our armed forces aren't up to scratch. But then you get to the but, which is that when you talk about, as Max Hastings does, this idea of national sacrifice, what lots of people will say to you in response is, well, it's felt like national sacrifice since the financial crash. It's felt like, you know, life has been getting harder. We've been having to do more with less, or in some cases, less with less. So it's a really hard message to land. If you focus on that specific question of should we cut the welfare budget in order to bolster defence, people are slightly more likely than not to say we should. It's about 56% to 44%. Mm. But of course, very often when the public are thinking about the welfare budget, they're thinking specifically about the universal credit element, much less about, you know, things like disability benefits, which are a big chunk, and certainly not about pensions, which of course are a very big chunk of the welfare budget. And we've seen from previous attempts to restrict old age benefits that there is quite a lot of public backlash.
Because pensioners, pesky pensioners, have this thing that they do, they vote. And it really does mean that they have huge influence. And look, many people would say justifiably so. Is the triple lock in any way vulnerable, Luke? What do you think?
Well, look, it would take, I still think, a brave politician to make an argument that we should reduce or tweak the triple lock. That's obviously not to say they shouldn't do it. You know, politicians are there to lead, not just follow public opinion. But the interesting thing about something like the triple lock is that actually even younger generations tend to back it. And when we chat to them in focus groups, they say, well, you know, I worry about my grandparents. I want to make sure that they're being looked after. So, you know, support for it spans right across the population. And I just wonder whether there needs to be more kind of warming up, more of a conversation with the public and levelling with them about what we can and can't afford. Because when we ask people, we have another question we ask, which is, you know, basically to balance the budget, do we need to raise taxes? Should we cut spending? Actually, the public opt for a third option, which is, can't we just cut waste? And you can't blame them for saying that, because every election, politicians say, we're going to take money out by efficiency, by tackling the waste of the last government, that's how we'll do it. And that's trickled through to the public. So they see it as a false choice between cuts versus investment versus taxes. They think there's that waste option.
OK, do you think that the risk, I was going to say the potential risk, but let's just say it's the risk from Russia, has got through to the vast majority of the public? I'm thinking about our undersea cables, for example. There's no doubt that Russian ships have been sniffing around them. And frankly, terrible things would happen if those cables were cut. Do most people get it?
I think they're certainly starting to. In fact, I was doing a focus group, what you might call road trip around South Wales over the weekend, and those Russian incursions came up repeatedly. Again, adding to this sort of wider sense of discombobulation, that people worry that, you know, we can't keep the country safe, we can't protect ourselves. People really looking for reassurance. So as I say, it might be that now is that time to have that conversation, that we need to do more, we need to put more into the defence budget. But you've got to, I think, pitch drill very carefully and also say to the public, and this is how we're going to make your lives better as well. So it's really difficult, given people feel they've been struggling for so long, to suddenly say, and here's another thing.
Yeah, well, can I just bring in the listeners? We've got a message here from a listener who works, I think, in horticultural services, garden services. And they say that I'd be happy to pay more tax, but it's got to be ring-fenced. It would have to be just for defence. Now, is it possible to do that, Luke? Could you have, and correct me if I'm wrong, I don't know, the 21st century equivalent of what used to be called a war bond? Would that work?
Well, look, I mean, certainly there might be people amongst the public who would be attracted to the idea of buying into war bond if they could say this is going specifically towards defence. There's also, you know, one of the things you could have is this idea of sort of hypothecated taxes, which is this is a tax and it is going to a specific place. You remember Rishi Sunak tried to do that with a national insurance rise that he said was for the NHS and then social care in time. It actually didn't last very long, that rise. So you can do it, but we also know that the Treasury doesn't like those types of taxes because they like to be able to move things around. Yeah, I mean, I do think, you know, appealing to the spirit of kind of national endeavour, particularly given the risks, might work. But again, you know, the public would want that reassurance. It was being spent in the right places. And as well, not just that it was going to defence, but that the MOD was spending it right. Because that's the other thing. Mm. There's no doubt that stories about bad MOD procurement, MOD waste, have also cut through to the public.
Yes, but also, I know what's cut through to the public is the idea of Britain being humiliated in terms of our defences. The idea that we have to ask the French for help, we have to borrow ships from other European nations. This is not what we're supposed to be about, is it?
No, and it has a bigger impact than just on perceptions of defence. It goes to the sort of heart of Brits' national psyche, this sense of we can't defend ourselves. You know, there's a, you know, nostalgia for an era when the Navy, the Royal Navy, was the most powerful maritime force. Obviously, that was a long time ago now. But this sense that, you know, we can't even send a ship to defend our bases, it really knocks national self-confidence. And I think feeds into that wider sense of something's gone badly wrong in our country. You know, when we ask people to describe Britain in a word, the word they're most likely to use is broken. And part of that is around public services, cost of living. But it's also about things like this. You know, we can't get a ship out to our bases.
And now we hear that Britain will have the lowest growth and highest inflation in the G7. Actually, a few listeners just asking why. Why do we find ourselves in that position? Can you answer that, Luke?
Well, it's probably a little beyond my pay grade, which is on public opinion. But, you know, there are a series of issues, like, you know, particularly vulnerability on things like energy bills. And again, when you ask the public, they come up with a range of different sort of solutions to that, whether it's further investment in renewables or more drilling in the North Sea. But, you know, I think as a taken across the piece, whether it's the economy, whether it's defence, this sense of lack of national resilience, actually, that's probably the way to sum it up, because that spans both, is particularly pernicious.
Right. And the idea of protest on the streets in terms of what's happening in Ireland, say, about fuel prices, you do feel, farmers in particular may feel they have a case here, that possibly we're not far from that right now. What do you think?
No, I think so. And actually, when we went back, going back to sort of 2022, 2023, when we asked people, did they think that there would be riots or protests about the cost of living then? It was actually a significant chunk of the public who thought that there would be. I wouldn't be surprised if we see similar things now, particularly as we head towards the summer. And a lot of it just born out of that sense of desperation. You know, we've hit the last straw. I spoke to a woman in South Wales this weekend who was saying, you know, I've become obsessed with petrol prices. It's all that I can think about at the moment because I'm so worried about when it's going to jump up next. It really goes to the heart of how people are thinking and feeling. And yeah, I think in some cases we can expect that to boil over into real frustration and anger.
Just really briefly, Luke, did you meet anybody who was positive or even vaguely optimistic?
I have to say it was a fairly gloomy. We spoke to in focus groups right across South Wales and very few people were confident about the future. A few people saying we might want to give the government a bit more time, but most saying, you know, they felt like everything just felt, I guess, a bit adrift.
Luke, thank you, I think. No, always good to have you on the programme. Appreciate your advice and your input. Luke Trill is a pollster and UK director at More in Common. I mean, there's normally really buoyant people in South Wales, full of good cheer.
But the buoyancy is gone.
It does appear to have fizzled out just for the time being.
Well, we've been intrigued at the views and the success of the Artemis space crew. And I'm delighted to say that Peter Bee in the Times today tells you how you can now work out like an astronaut, Jane. And I'd just like to ask you, because I know that you care very much about space and your own fitness, whether you've done any of these exercises that could make you as fit as the Artemis crew.
Try me.
Do you stand on one leg every day to recalibrate your balance?
No, but I do it at Pilates once a week.
Do you do Pilates twice a week?
I don't.
Answered that question. Do you jump 10 to 20 times twice a day to regenerate cartilage and boost your bones?
No, but I walked past a man doing exactly that on Shepherd's Bush Green only this morning. Does that count?
Yes, it does.
Thank you.
Have you added high-intensity training to boost your heart health?
Not yet.
Are you investing in a wobble cushion to challenge underused postural muscles?
Well, if Times Radio could get me one, that would be ideal. Yeah.
Have you tried exercising on a vibration platform to strengthen your bones?
Certainly not.
You're not going into space. Coming up, we're going to talk about why so many British artists are being honoured in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this year, and Michael in Worthing is disappointed that the Pet Shop Boys aren't in there. It's a question and we will put it to our expert. You're listening to Jane and Fee here on Times Radio, 20 minutes past two.
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel.
Join us on Times Radio Breakfast from 6 o'clock in the morning for all the news, analysis and views to start your day.
While we've been focused on the Middle East, what have China and Russia been up to? And is Dr. AI the new Dr. Google?
Plus, we'll talk through all the day's news with loose woman Jane Moore and loose-ish man and Times columnist Giles Corran.
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel. Tomorrow morning from 6 on Times Radio.
Experience. It's knowing when something is worth waiting for and when it isn't. That's why Saga Health Insurance offers unlimited GP appointments whenever you need them. With a choice of flexible plans, prompt tests and treatment, your health is taken care of. And right now, you'll get a £250 gift card when you take out Saga Health Insurance. Search Saga Health Insurance for a quote today. Start a new policy before the 28th of May. New customers over 50 only. Terms and conditions apply.
Listen to Times Radio at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
22 minutes past two, so Brits are taking over the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame with a record... See, we're good at something, Jane.
Oh, yes.
A record number of UK acts set to be honoured this year. Let's hear them. Well, what an absolute treat. That was a mega mix put together by our executive producer /editor, Rosie Cutler. And you heard New Order, Sade, Billy Idol, Iron Maiden, Phil Collins, and finally Oasis. Let's talk to the music journalist Mark Beaumont. Hello, Mark.
Hiya.
Why does this year have so many more British inductees to the Hall of Fame than other years?
Well, I mean, it's tempting to think that it's down to the sort of the ping pong sort of back and forth of popular culture across the Atlantic over the decades, but the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame tends to be playing catch up quite a lot, so it's not really down to that. I think it's just down to kind of chance. What they try and do is they try and make a show that will be of mass appeal every year. And they also try and mark sort of events in popular culture. So, I mean, the situation we've got here, I mean, Phil Collins is unwell. So, it's very good to be honouring him at this point. Iron Maiden are on their 50th anniversary tour. You've got Oasis, obviously one of the biggest stories of the last year or so. Their reunion, absolutely huge. So I think it just happens to be a time when a lot of British bands and British acts are quite prominent in the sort of wider scheme of things, and so it looks like a good show to put on.
Well, it's a win and we'll take it, Mark, because we need them wherever we can find them at the moment. The other inductees who aren't British are Luther Vandross and Wu-Tang Clan. I think we ought to go back to basics here though, Mark, and just talk about what the Hall of Fame actually is. I mean, who started it? How do you get into it anyway? Is there a large committee? Is it a purely commercial venture? What is it?
Well, it started around, I mean, they first started inducting people in, I think, 1988. It is basically kind of a museum. And it's, I think there's thousands of acts vote for who should go in there. But it's been playing, as I say, it's been playing catch up for decades. I mean, they induct sort of, between 5 and 10 acts every year. And there's only so many they can get in there, and you've got to be releasing music at least 25 years ago, but at the same time, there's lots and lots of acts that are huge that needed to be inducted. So we're getting to the point now where bands like Oasis and Iron Maiden, which people could argue should have been in very, very long time ago, are only now being sort of admitted. And Phil Collins, it's very, very strange that he would only now be sort of put on the list. To a degree, there's a weird situation this year where both Oasis and Iron Maiden, they've previously been very disparaging about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and sort of pointed out how, you can repeat on the radio what they've said about it. But it's an interesting turnaround where it's got to the point where now these, maybe they've sort of exhausted so many big bands that, they have to go back to the people that aren't even sort of fans of the.
Yes. Well, I like your very diplomatic turn of phrase here, Mark, but I mean, let's just call it what it is. Liam was astonishingly rude about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and basically said, it was kind of run by people who didn't count and entered into by people who didn't count. But he has now tried to be gracious, hasn't he, and said that he would go along to the ceremony bearing some flowers and a box of chocolates and would offer a humble apology. So does it really mean something, actually, when you do get into it? Who's right in that kind of standoff?
Well, it depends how you kind of view the institution of it, really. There is a it's broadcast in America. There's a big audience there if people want to take advantage of it. But also, lots of acts don't want to go along and collect it because they kind of see it as, putting music in a museum is kind of against the idea of it being sort of fresh and ever changing.
So when it comes to that ceremony, how many of those people who have been inducted this year do you think would actually turn up?
Well, I don't think Phil Collins has been doing anything live. I can't imagine he will perform because he didn't perform at the final Genesis shows. I mean, you might see Iron Maiden turn up there. You may well see Oasis. I'd imagine.
Does Sade still play live?
I'm not entirely sure, actually. But they also put on a show that includes all sorts of huge names, so it's not necessarily just the new inductees. They try and use it often as a means to kind of get old bands back together as well. They really love a reunion. They will sort of use it as a temptation to get people back together. So you might find, an act or two like that are on the bill as well.
Are there any big names who are very upset never to have been invited?
I'm not sure. I'd have to look that one up.
Well, we will punt that out to our listeners. They're a very canny bunch of people. Jane, do you have a question? It looks like you do.
No, I'm just mulling it over. Are the Pet Shop Boys not in the Hall of Fame?
You'd be amazed at the names that aren't in there. That are huge here. And yeah. I mean, it's very kind of US based a lot of the time. I mean, because obviously it's a US centric thing. The museum's there. The show is broadcast there. So they do, they primarily deal with American acts. But there's a lot of British acts in there. But what's interesting this year actually is that because Joy Division and New Order are finally being admitted in there, that does kind of open the door to a lot of those kind of 80s sort of electronic acts that Pet Shop Boys may well be looked at in the near future.
I suppose they are too British. Are they just too British? Their lyrics are very British, aren't they? I mean, I love them, but I know not everybody, probably not an American massive hit, I wouldn't have thought.
Yeah, I mean, it very much often does depend how big they are in sales-wise in America. If you look down the British acts that have been included there, it's multi-platinum in America breakthrough acts. Obviously, Pet Shop Boys are a huge band, but, how did they make much impact in terms of American audiences?
Have you been to the museum, Mark?
I haven't, no. I wouldn't know what to expect. You kind of expect to go through and there'll be sort of animatronic Beatles and things in there, but I've not stopped off.
No, or maybe, it's that kind of museum where you have the tea towel that was once used to wash a cup that may have been in the proximity of Abbey Road 30 years ago. Who knows? Who knows? Yeah. Thank you very much indeed. That's the music journalist Mark Beaumont. If any of you have visited the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, I presume the museum's in Cleveland, Ohio, then we would love to hear what's in there. We'd like to know a little bit about this, please. It all sounds a little bit mystical. A little bit commercial, Jane.
Oh, it does, darling, and we don't approve of that at all. A brief nod to Debs, who says, not Oasis, please. Liam Gallagher, I tell you what, she doesn't forgive Debs. Liam Gallagher was very, very rude to Michael Hutchence at the Grammys, calling him and in excess has-beens who shouldn't share the stage with bands like Oasis. Well, Michael Hutchence left us some time ago, didn't he?
Well, he did, and I don't know, if you collect all of the things that Liam has said in public over the last 30 years. I don't know. Do they have the air of Luke Trill's focus group about them? They're definitely on the sour side of life.
Yeah. He does look good in waterproof clothing, though, doesn't he? He always seems to wear one of those incredibly expensive anoraks whenever he appears on stage. But somehow it works.
How do you know it's not a Pac Mac? Well, those very handy ones to keep in your bag.
Coming up on Times Radio, why has it taken the government so long to agree to a ban on strangulation in porn, and how, honestly, can it be enforced? Here are the headlines just after 2:30. It's James Kitchen.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. Britain's economic prospects have been downgraded by more than any other G7 country, according to new forecasts by the International Monetary Fund. It found the effects of the Iran war will see the UK economy grow by just 0.8% this year. The Chancellor has vowed to keep inflation and interest rates in line. At least two ships, including a Chinese-linked tanker, have crossed the Strait of Hormuz, challenging a US blockade. Beijing has condemned the American move as dangerous and irresponsible, warning it will only exacerbate tensions. The former head of NATO says Sir Keir Starmer is not willing to make the necessary investment in defence. Lord Robertson warns Britain's leaders are putting the country in peril. In a speech later, he'll accuse non-military experts in the Treasury of vandalism and also take aim at what he calls the ever-expanding welfare budget. Sir Simon Mayle is former deputy chief of the defence staff.
We are detached from society. The narrative is not out there about defence and security for a number of reasons since the Cold War. all governments have been guilty of taking that peace dividend time and again, and it's a very difficult narrative to turn around.
The boss of South East Water, David Hinton, has turned down his £115,000 bonus. It's after the company admitted that leaving thousands of homes without water last winter was untenable and a failure. An Albanian gang who carried out at least 59 high-value burglaries in 8 counties of England have been jailed for nearly 40 years between them. The 4 men ransacked the properties they targeted, stealing jewellery, designer handbags, watches and cash. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio. The Times Radio advertising event is nearly full. If you've been waiting for the right moment, this is it. When it comes to advertising, hesitation can cost you growth. Join us May the 11th to the 15th and walk away with a custom campaign for your business, event-only prices, and free creative, professionally produced and ready to launch. Elevate your profile where trust matters. Register now at newsrsvp.co.uk/radio. That's newsrsvp.co.uk/radio. And start being heard.
AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. That's why it's no surprise that more than 85% of the Fortune 500 use the ServiceNow AI platform. While other platforms duct tape tools together, ServiceNow seamlessly unifies people, data, workflows, and AI, connecting every corner of your business. And with AI agents working together autonomously, anyone in any department can focus on the work that matters most. Learn how ServiceNow puts AI to work for people at servicenow.co.uk.
Get the day's politics, business and sport every weekday in Breakfast from 6:30 a.m. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Now, a lot of you are very keen to just carry on talking about Sade, and we would be happy to as well. It would be great to have her on as a guest. I'm not sure that she's very publicity-facing, though, Jane.
I think
but
she needs to be, doesn't
no,
she?
No, it's definitely worth an ask. And Harry says, I went to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame with my family when I was 8 or so. It's where I learnt about Janis Joplin. One of her cars was there. And my parents, both hippies, loved showing me more about her life and have been a fan ever since. And Ian says, very interestingly, that he went to see Wu-Tang Clan at the O2 and they asked the audience to get involved in getting them awarded the Hall of Fame status.
Oh, I didn't realise that. Oh, so you can ask your fans to
yes,
chip in.
Yes, an audience dial in will definitely help, a little bit like Eurovision then. John Pienaar takes over from us at 4 o'clock. Hello, John.
Hi there. All right, so, George Robertson. I mean, you don't see many speeches making such big headlines and causing such a stir before it's even been uttered, because George Robertson, he gives this speech about 7 o'clock this evening in Salisbury, and he's already said the government is guilty of complacency, corrosive complacency, and just not dealing with the problem of our inadequate defences, facing a really serious threat from Russia. So that's got the cats, who were already among the pigeons, running around and causing even more of a noise. And my show today is going to be clanking with insignia and medals. I've got Lord West, the former First Sea Lord, on first of all at 4 o'clock. He's going to be coming in, and I think echoing what George Robertson will be saying and what we know he's going to say. And later on the American side, I've got General Stephen Anderson, who's a former chief logistician for coalition forces. He was under General Petraeus. And I've got Peter Ricketts, who's a former national security advisor to the British government. So we've got a lot of what people have been worrying about, in many cases publicly, even more so privately, now bubbling up in the way that it is. I'm going to be looking at Iran, as you'd expect, and maybe trying to find something of an insight into what is going on in the negotiations, which are resuming later on in the week. There's been some interesting reporting in the American media about the detail of what's going on. It's not exactly what a lot of people had imagined. And I'm going to be talking about Lebanon with a Lebanese MP and with a former ambassador. And also going to be looking, you mentioned AI, at the case which is reported in the Wall Street Journal. It's about a man who killed himself after getting enmeshed, entangled with a chatbot. But a journalist has gone through 5,000 messages from that chatbot. So we can have a good close look at the sort of thing that was going on that led to that tragedy.
All of that starts at 4 o'clock, John. Thank you very much.
22 minutes to three now, Times Radio. And the government has now committed to banning pornography depicting non-fatal strangulation, months after initially rejecting proposals to do so. Now, the measure was first put forward by the Tory MP Alicia Kearns and supported by the Independent Pornography Review led by Baroness Burton. But ministers did argue that existing laws were in fact sufficient. Campaigners warn that non-fatal strangulation is a significant risk factor in violence against women and girls, with reported cases rising by 87% in England and Wales since it was made a criminal offence back in 2022. I've been talking to Baroness Burton and asked her if she was relieved to have finally got to this point.
Yes, it's a huge relief, because when we first started, when I was asked to do this review into how do you regulate online pornography, I mean, I didn't go into it faint-hearted by any stretch of the imagination, but I mean, to be honest, the figures and the evidence that came through to us about how prevalent content like strangulation and how it was playing out in real life was just awful. And it just said to me, look, this industry is not being led by our taste. It's shaping our taste, because you're not telling me 10 years ago that was a hugely sort of niche, highly, you know, unusual activity. And now you've got 66% of sexually active girls between the age of 16 and 34 have been strangled. I mean, that's just it's unacceptable.
Wow. Sorry. Nearly 70% of girls and women in that cohort said they'd been strangled.
Yes.
God, I mean, that's...
And even more worryingly, a very high proportion had not consented to that. So I can't really overstate how troubling that is, because, you know, I went into this work because of campaigning for to end violence against women and girls, and I felt it was ridiculous to make speeches in sort of enormous bills, you know, domestic abuse bill, the crime bill, when you're not trying to attack the sort of breeding ground or trying to sort of stop off what's creating this. And if you've got boys who are watching this kind of porn, the first thing they see, I mean, the Children's Commissioner, I realise we've got age verification, we can perhaps can come on to that, but, you know, we've had decades now, or nearly, you know, 15 years now of boys seeing this kind of content when they're so young. And the Children's Commissioner came out with a shocking statistic saying that a boy of 13, probably before he's had his first kiss, will have seen incest porn, rape porn and strangulation porn.
And then they're expected to unsee all that and go on to have a so-called normal sex life. How do we change that?
Well, indeed. And I think, you know, I'm not naive in thinking that this is going to all change overnight, but I do think the sort of the process of changing the law, changing the regulation, raising public awareness, sort of taking the taboo away from this and talking about it, like talking about it on shows like this. You know, when I first began doing this work, I didn't really get a great deal of media because, to be honest, no one quite knew how to sort of handle it, whether it was just something we shouldn't be talking about. And I would say quite the opposite. We've got to talk about it. We've got to sort of open this up and say, this is going on. And by the way, that some of the videos and the clips of content, which are very violent, and, you know, in some ways the strangulation part is PG compared to some of the very violent incest, step incest porn. You know, there are sort of millions and millions of views underneath those bits of content, and that is sort of sending the signal that, look, you know, this is normalized, people are watching it and it's okay. And I think the whole structure of how you regulate online porn has to change quite radically.
We do know that the definition of extreme pornography was extended to include non-fatal strangulation. It had already been made a criminal offence in 2022, but it wasn't classed as dangerous pornography. I mean, there's mixed messages there, surely.
Yes, and I think, you know, that's why I felt so determined to carry on with this work, because it did feel completely wrong to me. And I think likewise with some of the other genres of very popular pornography, it would be illegal in real life. So why on earth should it be, you know, legal to depict it in porn? It's encouraging a behaviour that is just completely unacceptable. So, look, governments sometimes take a while to sort of just, you know, they've got lots of things to do. I'm being kind, Jane, but, you know, It's right that the law catches up with what is happening in practice.
Right, and you're very clear on this. We don't shape porn. Porn increasingly is shaping us. But you've just referred there to so-called popular porn. So what is coming first? Well, the chicken and the egg thing. I must confess, I'm a bit baffled by all that.
The nature of porn that, let's say, 10 or 15 years ago, or when it was offline, has become far more extreme. And you know, that's people who regularly watch porn would say that. And that's a sort of, you know, well-established fact. And I think, again, if you're a sort of 50-year-old coming to this fresh, then you won't necessarily be affected by it. But if you're a very young person who's sort of forming their tastes and their and you know, in that journey on sort of in their sex life, it's I think, well, we know that it can change how you behave and what you want in you know, in your life going forward. And we've also heard... We heard a lot of compelling evidence as well about the sort of dysfunctionality, sexual dysfunctionality, increasingly with boys and young men, which I think is very problematic because they're victims as well in all of this.
And the more so-called extreme porn you view, the more extreme porn you'll be shown, and on and on we go.
Indeed.
Age verification, then, is that the solution?
Well, it certainly is really important, and it cannot be reversed. And I think if anything, it needs to be, you know, more device-led age verification would be helpful to be layered on top of platforms making their own age verification. But it's certainly true that, you know, people will circumnavigate age verification if they either don't want to put any personal details in with VPNs, or if, you know, if you're a 15, 16-year-old boy wanting to find porn, you'll still be able to find it. But I think it has certainly helped stopping very young children from sort of chancing upon stuff, which is also important. You know, some very, very young children have been terribly damaged by finding content by accident. So that you know, I certainly think the situation has been made better. But I think you can't take age verification and say, oh, that's it, job done. You know, there's stuff that shouldn't, whether you're 55 or 15, you shouldn't be seeing. And that's why the law, you know, the British Board of Film Classification that polices DVDs would not, which clearly no one's watching porn on DVDs anymore, that they would not allow, you know, vast majority of content that is now online. So that's the sort of work that we're trying to do here, and the work that I think is going through at pace.
Right.
I'm trying to sort of, you know, reduce that gap.
Yeah, I mean, that is so important to emphasise, that the stuff that was routinely available on DVD, honestly, it was tame compared to what is so easily accessible all over the place right now.
Exactly. And I think the other point to emphasise is that I'm very socially liberal. I'm not trying to ban porn. I'm just trying to get it back to the place within reason, where it sort of was, or certainly try and, you know, to sort of do some kind of reset to say, look, the sort of having sex with your stepfather or encouraging sex between siblings, that's not okay. You know, this is not a normal thing. Likewise, strangling, you know, your partner is also not okay. So this is not sort of a disproportionate throwing the baby out with the bathwater. It is a very proportionate, sensible place just to get back to where the offline law was.
And you're so right. Unless this is talked about in public, and it is uncomfortable, and frankly, a lot of people will find it unpleasant, but it's absolutely essential, isn't it?
I think so. I mean, well, again, the sort of, when we first started having the meetings is when I was leading the review, and I went into sort of various government departments and various regulators. They honestly, the whole issue of online pornography just hadn't been addressed at all. And I think that would be fine if it was just a sort of, you know, 3,000 people doing it. But it's like a third of the nation, a third of men admit, well, not admit, but we know from very sort of, you know, Ofcom figures that it's estimated that a third of men watch porn on a weekly basis, probably more. And I don't judge that particularly. It's just a fact. So you can't not have guardrails in place when something is being consumed at such scale.
And let's be honest, plenty, one would assume, the majority of men in Parliament do exactly that.
I couldn't possibly comment. I've no idea. But I certainly think that we have to... remove a taboo about talking about this. Well, and that's why I'm afraid. Yeah. I people sort of almost cross the street when they see me as I think, what's this woman going to say to them?
But she's
I
porn think obsessed.
She's obsessed, exactly. But no, I think I'm afraid you have to take the embarrassment away and then get the job done and sort it out.
Well, no, look, I'm completely with you, but it is notable that the Tory MPs who are quoted in the press release, for example, Alicia Kearns and Dame Caroline Dynage, where are the men in this?
Well, I think that, I don't think that's a fair thing to say. The Lords, when we debate this in the Lords, I Tim Clement-Jones, it was cross-party. We had I've had a lot of men have spoken out on this, and I'm grateful for them to that, because it shouldn't just be a sort of men versus women domain. But you know, I think there's some areas where perhaps men feel they can't speak out on this subject. But I hope they, you know, I think we all need to speak out on it. So I'm very welcoming.
That is Gabby Burton, Baroness Burton, Tory peer, who led the Independent Pornography Review.
Any thoughts on that? We're 0333 003 2353. Thank you for using that number to Anne, who sent us some fantastic pictures from her visit to the Cleveland Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Museum. I visited it. Really interesting, she says. Lots of information on Johnny Cash. See his famous black coat. And also my idol, Bruce Springsteen, as well as many others. And Anne goes on to say, Cleveland, less interesting. Simon says Michael Hutchins apparently felt very embarrassed by Liam Gallagher's insult, which came when his career was on a downward trajectory and just a year before his death. I've never liked Oasis since. More happily, though, says Simon, Sade lives up the road from me and enjoys a quieter life, it seems, having found the love of her life. She hasn't toured since 2011. George Michael said Sade was the only artist that he wanted to duet with who had turned him down. Thank you. God, the lovely detail.
They would have been good together.
Oh, that
they?
Would have been phenomenal.
Sounds like Sade's living a diamond life. Doo-doo-doop.
Well done, sister. Coming up, we're going to play the health blame game with Dr. Rachel Ward. It's 10 minutes to 3, Jane and Fee on Times Radio.
The Evening Edition with Kate Borsay on Times Radio, hosting an honest conversation about current affairs, well-being, lifestyle, health and wealth. Plus, don't miss Tomorrow's Home, highlighting how you can make your house more energy efficient. The Evening Edition with Kate Borsay, tonight from 7 on Times Radio, with the UK government's boiler upgrade scheme. You could upgrade your heating with a £7,500 heat pump grant. Visit gov.uk/cleanenergy to check eligibility.
The Story, the award-winning daily news podcast from The Times. Listen in the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
In a world of noise and uncertainty, IG is the investment platform that backs you. Take our flexible stocks ISA, which gives you the freedom to withdraw funds anytime and replace them in the same tax year, all without losing your £20,000 tax-free allowance. And if that's not enough, pay no commission on your stocks, shares and ETFs when you invest with IG. IG. Trade. Invest. Progress. Your capital's at risk. Other fees may apply. Tax treatment depends on individual circumstances and is subject to change.
First time in premium economy, you'll double check your ticket. Second time, you'll wonder why you waited. Third time, you'll never go back. With generous legroom, Wi-Fi and dishes by Michelin-starred chefs, you'll feel like Asia just got closer. Cathay Pacific. Move beyond.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Health news now. Spider bite hospital admissions are up. Blame the false widows. Doctors are still striking. Blame them or Wes. And kids are obese. Blame school dinners no more. Let's play the blame game with Dr. Rachel Ward, our resident GP. Hello, Rachel. How are you?
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. School meals first. Chicken nuggets are going to be banned. Desserts must contain at least 50% fruit. These are the latest rules, aren't they, around school meals. Can you just tell us as a doctor what the effect is that you've seen of poor school meals on kids who come to your surgery?
Well, I think it's important to say to start with that school meals are only one important aspect of a child's diet. But of course, if it's a good opportunity for us to put some good standards and to set some good habits for children. But of course, eating at home is equally as important. But what we know at the moment is a third of children leaving primary school, so children who are 11 in year six, are overweight or obese. And that obviously has huge health implications going forward. And that really is a public health disaster waiting to happen in the coming years when those children start having problems like heart disease, diabetes, and all of the other diseases which it increases your risk of. So this really is a huge issue. So I think though we can kind of look at the surface of these changes for school meals, I think actually this is an incredibly important move forward to try and set some habits for good children. So reducing the amount of fried food, reducing the amount of sweet puddings, high salt, high fat items, and trying to increase the amount of fresh fruit and vegetables, whole grains, and generally fresh food in school meals.
Henry Dimbleby makes the point, though, that unless you enforce this through inspection, things really might not change. And it is true, Rachel, isn't it, that
yeah.
we've had so many attempts before to change the system, and yet here we still are.
Absolutely. And I think so. This is obviously still in pretty early stages. There's going to be a period of consultation now. But as part of these plans, it is reported that there's going to be monitoring and assessment and ensuring that these standards are kept to. And I think that's, you know, we don't want that to be a punitive thing. What we actually want is we want schools to be supported in offering healthy meals. There's also a real concern. Some schools are thinking, how are we going to do this financially with the small budget that we get given? There are ways, there are schools, there are education authorities who have done amazing things with their school meals. Schools that, for example, have partnered through Love British Food, and they're working with local producers, local farmers, and they've done incredible transformations with their school meals. And I really think that that's what needs to be pushed forward, kind of increased support to help schools provide this.
Absolutely. And it's a story that we are undoubtedly going to return to and keep our eye on before we do. Let's move on, though, because we've got two other stories to cover with you. And this news about false widow spiders, I mean, it's intriguing as well as being disturbing. How much are spider bites up in terms of hospital admissions? Are we being overrun by them?
Not overrun. So we're still talking really small amounts. So over the last decade, the number of hospital admissions due to complications of spider bites has doubled. So it was 100 admissions in 2025. So, I mean, if you think of that over the population, it's still a really small number. It's not something that you need to lose sleep over. But the feeling is that this is probably related to the increased population of the false widow spider. This is a pretty small spider which originally comes from Madeira and the Canary Islands. We see it in houses and it does bite. Interestingly, it's not the actual bite that is particularly the problem. It's the bacteria that the spider carries. So when it bites you, you can again get an infected wound and you can develop things like cellulitis, which obviously can be quite significant. And you can sometimes need admission for things like IV antibiotics. So it's a relatively small number, but it's, you know, it's always worth knowing about these things. If you get a bite and it's starting to become nasty, become infected. Also, a really good thing to know is that actually this is, again, one of those conditions that you can go to your local pharmacy about and they can give you antibiotics if needed. Don't need to see your GP about it.
And is there anything that you can do if you get to the bite super speedily? If you applied some kind of, you know, antibacterial or, you know, special bite cream, would you be able to stop an infection?
I mean, always worth giving things a little rinse, a little bit of an anti-bac wipe, but I think might help. But, you know, sometimes if that bacteria has gone inside, it can still culminate in a bit of an infection. But yeah, always worth giving things a clean and seeing if that's enough.
Right. I think it's the name that strikes terror, Rachel, isn't it? I mean, if it was just called the XY2F spider, I don't think we'd even be talking about it, but it's a false widow.
Oh, she's gone.
I'm still here. I'm still here, just enjoying it.
She's just too scared. Let's have a couple of minutes on the continued standoff between Wes and the resident doctors. Now, Rachel, I know you were very sympathetic to their cause and actually helped to explain why when the strikes first started. I don't know whether you've been on any particularly different journey since then. It's the 15th round of strikes since 2023. Are you still firm in your support of the doctors?
So I think there's two. I've been kind of thinking about, you know, the ins and outs of this. And I think there's a couple of things to think about here. First of all, I will kind of return to my thoughts that I really think that the situation that junior doctors find themselves in, with high student loans, relatively low income compared to other professionals, and huge obstacles that they have to get through to get a job, and then the fees and exam fees, etc., that they have to pay to keep that job, are just not sustainable. But I've also been thinking about this in a different way. So to train a doctor in the UK, it costs taxpayers, the figure that I've seen quoted is about £300,000. Now, we're in a situation at the moment where this year there were 50,000 applicants for 13,000 training jobs. So that is just simply very poor workforce planning. Now, of course, we have to have a sympathy for these doctors. That's just not acceptable, to be put on a career path where there's just not jobs at the end of it. But this has to be a real issue that the government has to solve. They are the ones that are responsible for workforce planning in the NHS. And there is a big problem with it at the moment. So love it or loathe the junior doctors, have a look at it from a different angle. It's the government's responsibility to manage that workforce. And at the moment, that is absolutely not working, which is leading to doctors leaving the UK and a huge loss of taxpayers' investment in their education.
Rachel,
so that is real.
Rachel. Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm sorry to cut you off because you're making some very good points there. Dr. Rachel Ward is our resident GP.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
And good afternoon, 3 o'clock. This is Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio. And in the next hour, researchers have achieved a step forward in uncovering the genetic causes behind neurodevelopmental disorders globally. We're going to be talking to Oxford Professor Nikki Whiffen and to the Sunday Times' James Coney to explore what this could mean for affected families, including James's own. Now, the manager of Bournemouth is leaving the club at the end of the season. Bournemouth, of course, perhaps surprisingly, beat Arsenal at the weekend. So why is he gone and who'll replace him? And our big guest after 3:30 today is the journalist and novelist Tom Bradby. He's got a new thriller out called Red Scorpion. What's the name of that spider?
False Widow.
Red Scorpion. Got them all here today. Here's the news at 3, James Kitchen.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. The Chancellor has vowed to keep interest rates in line as new forecasts reveal Britain will sustain the largest hit to growth from the Iran war in the G7. The International Monetary Fund warns the UK economy will also suffer the joint highest inflation. The Times' newsroom reporter Ollie Cole has more.
The IMF says the conflict could plunge the world into the largest energy crisis in modern times if all sides continue to escalate. The surge in oil and gas prices since the first strikes on Iran will hit growth in the UK hard and propel inflation to double the Bank of England's target. The IMF warned that growth would be 0.5 percentage points slower relative to its January forecast at 0.8% this year. Inflation is on track to average 3.2% in 2026 and head towards 4%, the joint highest rate of price growth with the US in the G7.
It comes as Sir Keir Starmer and Emmanuel Macron prepare to co-host a summit in Paris on Friday to examine ways of reopening the Strait of Hormuz. The French president says he wants to promote a peaceful multinational mission aimed at restoring freedom of navigation, insisting it will be strictly defensive. Meanwhile, at least two ships, including a Chinese-linked tanker, have crossed the strait challenging a US blockade. Beijing has condemned the American move as dangerous and irresponsible, warning it will only exacerbate tensions. The US Vice President J.D. Vance has accused Iran of economic terrorism, saying two can play at that game after the regime closed the shipping lane. The Times' foreign correspondent Richard Spencer says the blockade could ease a return to ceasefire talks.
They will go back to the negotiating table. I think Iran has a vested interest in negotiations, has a vested interest in keeping the conversation about what its goals are open as long as possible to stop itself getting bombed.
The Prime Minister and the Chancellor are being accused of complacency on defence by the author of the government's own review. In a speech later, the former NATO chief, Lord Robertson, will warn the UK's underprepared and not safe, adding Britain's national security is in peril. Funding for the Defence Investment Plan appears to be holding up its release. The former Labour Defence Secretary, Lord Hutton, told Times Radio Britain has been on the wrong trajectory.
We've assumed that the only real threats we needed to face were those posed by terrorists or non-state actors. And really, since 2014, that's been clearly not right. I mean, when Russia annexed Crimea, and then a few years later when it invaded the Ukraine, I mean, it was quite obvious that we'd entered a new era of geopolitical threats to the UK, and we just weren't responding at all.
The boss of South East Water has turned down his £115,000 bonus after the company admitted leaving thousands of homes without water was untenable and a failure. The firm's board refused to sack David Hinton, despite MPs saying they were flabbergasted by the mess the company was in. South East Water caused outages for tens of thousands of properties across Kent and Sussex in November, December and January, closing schools, businesses and a medical facility. For a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Richard has been driving back home from Cheltenham to Hove and stopping for a sandwich on the M4. What type of sandwich did you have, Richard? Can't believe it's taken so long for Sade to be inducted into the Hall of Fame. I've been listening to her music pretty much every day for many years. My ideal evening would be Sade at Ronnie Scott's. Well, I think that we might have to have a little bit of Sade on standby sometime between now and 4 o'clock, don't you?
I'm just looking at Ryan. Has he been inspired to dig up some Sade?
Yeah, he will. But we'll do it in a couple of moments' time. Leave the spiders alone, says Andrew. Tell people to clean their bites. This is a country of absolute sissies that worry every day about every little thing that causes them discomfort.
I haven't heard the word sissy for a while, have we?
Welcome back.
No.
Here she is. You see, everybody's happy. Everybody in the studio is just lost in a little bit of reverie. Are you back in the late 1980s?
Just sounds like the sun's out, doesn't it?
Doesn't it just?
Potentially, I've got a spicy marg and a big family bag of Christmas.
Yeah. There's some editorial management people doing chair dancing outside.
Yes, that's uncomfortable.
Yeah, it's time to stop. We don't want to look at that.
Stop.
Thank you.
Richard says it was chicken and avocado. Oh, thank goodness. It wasn't one. You didn't go for that sandwich where the cornichon is missing. I mean, that's just a publicity stunt, isn't it? I mean, everyone's talking about it, including me.
Yes.
It's just cobblers.
We are fascinated by it, but also nobody can answer the question, why don't you just cut up a gherkin?
Yeah, well said.
Scientists have made major new advances in understanding a tiny group of genes which have now been linked to one of the most common causes of neurodevelopmental disorders worldwide. Using cutting-edge genome editing, researchers can now identify exactly which genetic changes cause these conditions and even predict how severe a child's disability might be. The breakthrough is helping deliver diagnoses to thousands of families and is being hailed as a crucial step towards targeted treatments for conditions that until recently had no clear explanation. Well, let's talk to Nikki Whiffen first, who leads the Computational Rare Disease Genomics Group at Oxford University's Big Data Institute. Gosh, does all of that fit on a calling card, Nikki? I hope so. Can you just put this into layman's terms for us? Because it's a really significant breakthrough, isn't it? But what does it mean to people?
Yeah, so there are thousands of different neurodevelopmental disorders. And
For about 50% of them, we know what the genetic cause is, and for about 50%, families currently don't have an answer. So us as researchers, we're constantly trying to find the new causes of those neurodevelopmental disorders. Now, some genes were identified that had a role in these conditions kind of 10, 20 years ago. And most of those genes are very, very large genes that are the instructions to make proteins, which are these kind of workhorses in our cells. And what we pretty much ignored was the rest of the genome, so the rest of our DNA that doesn't make, that isn't those instructions to make proteins. And that's about 98.5%. So it's a lot of our DNA that doesn't make those proteins. And what we found very recently was a very, very small gene. It's 145 letters of DNA code long. To put that into perspective, these large protein coding genes are often thousands of letters long. So it's really, really tiny. And it doesn't provide the instructions to make one of those proteins. It instead is the instruction to make an RNA, which is often the precursor to a protein, but also has its own function within the cells.
So once you'd identified that, how are you able to tell that in practical terms, it tells you something about a child's condition and also how a child's condition might progress throughout their life?
This is really a kind of power of the patients, I should say. So a historical way of trying to find a diagnosis for a family is a very kind of family at a time approach. So we do clinical genetic testing for one family and look for something that might be the cause of their disorder. And then a few years ago, under David Cameron, the government invested in doing genome sequencing on a larger scale and putting all of this data into one place. And you may have heard of the Genomics England 100,000 Genomes Project, which is what this kind of flagship project was. And us researchers can access that data and we look for patterns and say, well, is there anything that sticks out here? Is there any changes in the sequence of the genome that are more common in individuals with neurodevelopmental disorders and not seen in anybody else? And that's exactly what we could see here. This lit up like a lamppost. We found a lot of individuals with changes in the sequence in a very, very tiny region of this gene.
So can you, maybe using an example, tell us what it would mean to the treatment that would then be available to a child that you know, simply hasn't been considered before this breakthrough happened?
So without a genetic diagnosis, families are limited to treatments that treat symptoms. So they have seizures, so we can put them on anti-seizure medication, and we try and treat the kind of different sub-factors of a disease. But with a genetic diagnosis, we can start to target the root cause of the disease and actually try to fix what's happening, what's going wrong in cells using a therapy. And that's exactly what we can do here. So basically, a genetic diagnosis is the first hope of being able to develop a therapy.
If this were to be a movie in which you would have the starring role, is there a kind of eureka moment, you know, where everybody in the lab goes, we've done it, we've absolutely cracked it?
So this one was actually quite interesting. So this the initial discovery was made by a student in my team called Yiang, who's just graduated from his PhD. And this was one of those cases of it's too good to be true. So he showed me this result and I said, that's rubbish. That's clearly an error in the data. We need to put some better filters in our pipelines and do it better. But he was actually quite persistent and said, no, I'm sure there's something interesting here. So then we set on this whole journey of trying to disprove this result. And we just couldn't disprove it. And then we had to start believing that it was true.
Right. So that sounds like a bit of a near-miss moment, Nikki.
Well, I think this is one of the reasons that we didn't find it until a couple of years ago, is that it does look like exactly what we'd expect an error in the sequencing data to look like.
Right, but it's not. It's so far from an error. Let's talk now to James Coney, who's with us as well, News Projects Editor of the Sunday Times. We've talked before, James, in your capacity as a kind of professional news journalist, but also in your capacity as a dad, because this kind of breakthrough really affects your family, doesn't it? Can you tell us why?
Yeah, so my son Charlie, who's now 13, for years and years, he's learning disabled, and so he's nonverbal, he's not toilet trained, he struggles with lots of kind of things, like gets very overwhelmed by things, lots of behavioral problems, very quite poor mobility, really. And since, you know, at about 1-2 years old, we realized he wasn't growing properly. He was, you know, he was like, we used to kind of joke that he was a very quiet, you know, he was a floppy baby. You don't really know what's going on at that age. And between the ages of 1 and 2, we went through loads and loads of kind of kind of physical medical testing. You know, he had an MRI that showed, you know, his brain growth wasn't necessarily what you would hope it to be. But there were lots of other things that were done, that lots of blood tests and other kind of testing that were done that just basically showed that he was a long way behind. And at age two, you walk out of a hospital and they give you this, well, it's a kind of diagnosis, non-diagnosis. Lots of kids in this situation are given what's called global developmental delay. And that just means there's something wrong with your child and we don't know what. And then you're kind of thrown out into the world and you're made to get on with it. And it's a very lonely place because you've got this child who you're constantly trying to, you don't know what the symptoms are going to be. You're learning to adapt to it as they get older, as they're constantly falling behind. You've got, you know, what we found was that you lacked community. There were other groups out there on the internet for kids with, you know, with autism or with cerebral palsy or with Downs. You know, we became quite jealous of families who've got kids with Downs because they had this wonderful community of people that were all working together. And you've got this child who doesn't fit in. But, you know, you kind of learn to live with that and you're kind of thrown into this world of disability, trying to grapple with it, not really knowing what to do, kind of not fitting into the system. And as Nikki mentioned, we probably about 5 years ago, or no, longer than that, sorry, we were asked to do the 100,000 Genome Project. And so we trotted along to the hospital. We all gave up, me, my wife and Charlie all gave our bloods. And then nothing happened. And at one point we got a letter saying 100,000 Genome Project is now closed, but, you know, your blood's been put into this data bank. You hear nothing. And then 2 years ago, just after Nikki's eureka moment, we get this eureka moment. We suddenly, out of the blue, get this phone call from the hospital that says, by the way, this thing that you forgot about that 10 years ago has had a result. Charlie's DNA had been put into the 100,000 Genome Project, and because of that, got this diagnosis from what Nikki's work did. And it was RNU42 was the name of the gene. And suddenly we had a syndrome. It's called Renew Syndrome. And the world changes, because although nothing has changed with Charlie, there's no cure or anything at the moment. Although, you know, this is part of the amazing work that Nikki's doing and kind of all this new research that the door has been open to. Suddenly you're part of a community. There's these amazing Facebook groups now of kids who have got a similar child. And this amazing group of women in America, this woman, Jessica, in America, has set this amazing nonprofit over there where they've brought all these people together. Over here in the UK now, in June, there's the first get-together of families in the UK who have got all of these children who are suddenly all linked from around the country, and they're starting a charity. They've just started raising, you know, they've got the funds to start a charity. You're going to get this. Suddenly there's all these parents who are sharing ideas and experiences about their children, and your child suddenly fits into something.
And what Nikki was saying, James, as well, about in families like yours, you've only had the ability to treat the symptoms of what your child has been going through, whereas now you might be able to look forward and presumably just have a much better idea and pathway of not how to, you know, stop things from happening, but actually be prepared for maybe the next stage of Charlie's life. Or is that too simplistic?
I can't get my head around it.
Yeah.
Frankly, I mean, since Nikki made this amazing first breakthrough looking at non-coded DNA, it's impossible to kind of say how, you know, I didn't know anything about any of this science, but in the 2 years that I've learned about it, I now understand what, and Nikki's incredibly modest. It is the most astonishing breakthrough to decide to look at this one bit of the gene code and decide I'm going to look at that and investigate it and then come up with something so significant is astonishing. And since then, in that last 2 years, I mean, Nikki asked me to come to a conference where she was talking at, there's all these amazing pediatricians and genetic scientists and from around the country, and the speed of development in the period of time since there, from these initial breakthroughs that all these amazing scientists make to where we get to now. I mean, they're talking now about what I think Nikki calls renewopathies, which is the potential for treatment. Now, as a parent, I find that really, really hard to deal with. What does that mean? There's this idea that a recent breakthrough that Nikki's made would allow a bit of the... I'm looking at Nikki to try and stop me if I say something completely... that's going to get me in trouble with the scientific community. But essentially, that allows you to kind of turn off the bit of the faulty gene that would then allow for growth of Charlie's growth in a certain way. Now, I cannot even comprehend what that means, because, you know, Charlie is Charlie, and the way that he is now, you know, is the way that he is, and he's our child, and we've got used to it, severely learning disabled as he is. So the idea of a treatment almost makes me want to cry every time, but at the same time, I can't comprehend. I mean, on a simplistic level, I mean, Charlie doesn't have seizures. Some of these other children do have very profound seizures. They have brittle bones. They have lots of things which are more fundamentally problematic to them living a kind of happy life. And I think for them, that is something more significant. I'm looking at Nikki to see if she will agree.
So, during everything that you said, Nikki was not shaking her head. Thinking,
thank God for that.
Yeah, he's wrong. So as James basically said all the right things there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And we're in a kind of an incredible time for genetic medicines now, where we've made some incredible technological advances recently, that we can edit the genome, we can remove RNA from cells using different techniques, which means this discovery comes at the right time, that we do have that promise of being able to develop a therapy. Tempered hope, we don't know how much it can help these kids, but there is definitely hope.
Yeah. Can I ask you about funding? I mean, is enough available? Is this a government that can see the value in the work that you're doing?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we've not had problems with funding. There has been some issues recently with the Medical Research Council, which is the UK kind of medical science funder. Not 100% sure I can informedly speak to what's going on there. But for our work, we've kind of been very lucky at being able to fund it.
And can I ask you also about what's happening over in America, where definitely there is an administration which doesn't appear to value science? I wonder what your community thinks about that, because this needs to be a global thing, doesn't it?
It's an absolute disaster. So these discoveries rely on teamwork, collaboration across the world. We have the data set in the UK, but we need to validate our findings and say, is this something specific in this data set, or is this true around the world? So we talk to our international colleagues in the US, in France, Germany, etc., to find other patients to check that this is real. And the situation in America is absolutely terrible at the moment. It's very distressing for all of my friends who are scientists out there. It's so unpredictable. They cannot plan for their future. It's horrible. Mm.
I feel like we should just have one of those rousing, great big rounds of applause available to us just for your discovery, Nikki. It's so lovely, apart from anything else, to hear some really good news and some positive news. And James, you always speak so movingly about Charlie and about your family. And I think we all just really, really felt when you were explaining, you know, how much this has changed your life. We really felt that with you. So I appreciate you coming in.
As far as I'm concerned, Nikki is rock and roll.
She is rock and roll. She's in the Hall of Fame. And I think disarmingly modest about it as well. So thank you very much indeed, both of you, for coming in.
Well, that was brilliant and fascinating. And I regret to say that our next topic is back in the headlines. I can't believe it. It's hair pulling in football. That's with our sports guy, Vassos Alexander, in a couple of minutes' time. Times Radio, it's 21 minutes past three.
John Pienaar on Times Radio, telling the stories that matter.
How do you rate the seriousness of this situation? Because there have been upsets on the route to this point.
Expert analysis and well-informed discussion.
Half the population are women. It's astonishing that medical misogyny, it persists.
Trusted journalism and diverse opinion.
With the idea that you need to do it now and hope you don't have to do it again.
John Pienaar at Drive, this afternoon from 4 on Times Radio.
First time in premium economy, you'll double check your ticket. Second time, you'll wonder why you waited. Third time, you'll never go back. With generous legroom, Wi-Fi, and dishes by Michelin-starred chefs, you'll feel like Asia just got closer. Cathay Pacific, move beyond.
If you want your brand to stand alongside trusted journalism and be seen as credible and established, then visibility alone isn't enough. When it comes to advertising, are you simply staying visible or truly being heard?
At the Times Radio advertising event, you'll receive a custom campaign for your business, event-only prices, and free creative built to elevate your profile. May the 11th to the 15th. Register now at newsrsvp.co.uk/radio. Stop staying quiet. Start being heard.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Oh, can you believe it? Greg has been in touch. It wasn't Liam Gallagher who insulted Michael Hutchence. It was Noel.
Do you think we're going to be on the receiving end of a libel issue?
Ofcom. It's all going to come to an end for you over this.
Do you know what? I do not want my downfall to have been created by one of the Gallagher brothers.
God, the very thought.
Yeah.
I did see Noel on the telly, actually, on Sunday afternoon. Or was it Saturday when he was leaving Manchester City?
Yeah,
were
they
well
were 3-0 yeah. up at Chelsea. And he was in amongst the away fans, wasn't he?
Oh,
and he was
yes.
leaving. He looked quite cool, didn't he? He had a bit of an entourage, but quite a cool jacket. Mm. And a few fans were sort of high-fiving him as he left.
Yeah. Man of the people.
Do you know what? If he did bring us down, there's a great headline there, isn't there? High-flying birds crash.
Oh, God, that's absolutely genius. But, Greg, thank you. We can't stand it when people correct us, but we appreciate it as well. Right, let's talk sport with our sports guy, Vassos Alexander. Now, this is a bit of a surprise. The Bournemouth manager is leaving the club at the end of the season. Now, they've been doing really well.
Really, really well, yes. Andoni Iraola, he was appointed 3 years ago. They had a manager called Gary O'Neill who'd done really well for them, and they just sort of randomly replaced him with this Spanish guy that, honestly, I'd really never heard of him. I sort of had as a player. I didn't know he was pulling up any sort of trees as a manager. And he's come in and he has transformed. And they are... I mean, they and Brighton can sort of pat themselves on the back. They are little clubs. And Bournemouth's ground is really, really small. It's a wee, tiny little thing down on the south coast. And they sell their best players. I mean, most recently, Semenya to Manchester City for 60-odd million in January. And they haven't lost a game since in, 12 games. And they just recently beat Arsenal at the Emirates. I mean, he has lovely football to watch. He has transformed the club into a high mid-table Premier League side, which is significantly punching above their weight.
Yeah, no.
So he has done great, but the call of the Basque country, it is widely reported that where he was 400 plus games and 12 years as a player of Athletic Bilbao. And I think that's where he's heading. That's where it's widely reported he's heading in the summer. So I think Bournemouth fans will be like, fair enough. I remember when Scott Parker left Fulham for Bournemouth, us Fulham fans were like, sorry, Scott Parker, what? And we sort of still sing a little bit of slightly rude songs about him for that decision.
Get over it.
I know. But the Bournemouth fans, I think, will think, OK, no, fair play.
Right, OK, well, that's interesting. But who's going to... It's rather a good job, that, isn't it, for somebody? Who's going to go for that?
Well, it's one of those sort of after the Lord Mayor's show, because he has done so well and they have consistently sold their top players and then just brought through youngsters and then sold them for massive profits and then brought through... As long as that continues, and it has done, to be fair, at Brighton under various regimes, then it is a good job. There's the former Dortmund boss, Marco Rose, according to TalkSport upstairs. He's a leading contender, as is Ipswich's Kieran McKenna. Ipswich currently second in the championship, so as things stand, are heading for the Premier League.
OK, let's talk about hair pulling. And Manchester United's Lisandro Martinez has been ruled out of his club's next three games because he got a red card last night for pulling the ponytail of Leeds striker Dominic Calvert-Lewin. Now, as a nailed-on, crop-haired, lunatic feminist, I'm actually quite glad about this because I was rather depressed by the focus on the Arsenal women's player, Katie McCabe, who'd done hair pulling last week, because it did seem sort of... You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
That was a bit grim. But now the blokes are doing it too.
And I was on my way to the Serpentine in central London. I didn't watch the game last night, and I heard the TalkSport... massive going, but this is the most I heard Michael Carrick, the Manchester United manager, going, game's gone, it's one of the worst decisions I've ever seen. Ali McCoist was like, it's never a red card, so was Jeff Stelling upstairs. So I quickly put it on my phone and I had a look at it, and they sort of have a point. I mean, you know, when Katie McCabe did it in the Champions League quarterfinal against Chelsea, it was a full-on ponytail pull. Yeah. This was more of a... And Dominic Calvert-Lewin's ponytail wasn't quite sort of so fulsome as Katie McCabe's. It was sort of tied in a bit of a bun.
Yeah, keep going with this.
Well, no, I mean, and it was sort of just ruffled a bit, and the hair came out. Having said that, like we said last week, you know, pulling hair, hair is a part of the body, and that is violent conduct. So that's why VAR got involved, which, to be honest, it should have done in the Women's Champions League quarterfinal last week as well. And yes, violent conduct, red card. But as far as, you know, the two, the different sort of hair pulls are concerned, this one was quite soft. It was more of a tussle and a ruffle.
Tug. It was just a little tug. Yeah. We've all done it. Maybe the solution is just not to have ponytails. I mean, I'm conscious that I think the England women are playing Spain tonight, aren't they? There'll be so many high ponytails, a go-go on
that
pitch.
Well, I mean, you know, you could. I mean, the difference is they were tussling on the halfway line, the men last night, and... Yeah, the ponytail came loose from a sort of knot that he had, Dominic Calvert-Lewin, on the back of his head, whereas the Katie McCabe incident was more of a, like, you're running away from me, I'm not going to get your shirt because you're too far away, so I'll go for the ponytail. So it was more violent conduct. But yes, ponytail pulling is completely outlawed in the game. It's classed as violent conduct and hence the red card.
Okay. I mean, the man bun is the best solution.
It was the man bun. That's what it was. Yeah. It was a man bun that got pulled out.
Right. Oh, I don't like a man bun. Don't you? Sorry. I really don't.
If you look at the still... online in the Times, the sort of just the still picture of it, it does look like a ponytail pull. But if you look at the sort of the full video, it's like they're just having a bit of a grapple.
Yeah, it's all a bit playground.
How do you
it?
Like them grapples?
Well, yes, thank you very much, Fessels. Right. Maybe it's time for a return to hairnets. Well, some players do wear hairnets. I think I've seen a hairnet on the pitch before now.
I'm trying to think. Yeah, I'm trying to think who, but yes, I think you're probably right.
Sometimes I do wonder how many. Virgil van Dijk has the most extraordinary and incredibly well-coiffed man bun before every single game. And I'm actually thinking Liverpool have got that game against a PSG tonight, haven't they? Is it fair to say that Liverpool have it all to do, Vassos?
Well, they're 2-0 down from the first leg, but, I mean, it could have been worse. It could have been 5 or 6-0 down. And Arne Slot, actually, it's really weird listening to him after that first leg in Paris when his team were completely outplayed and they did really well to only lose 2-0 and it was only because of PSG just didn't finish very well. It could have been 5 or 6 and Liverpool didn't turn up. And he went, yeah, basically we didn't turn up. I'm really pleased it's only 2-0. It's almost like he was waving the white flag, both for his job and for the tie. But you never know. They turned it round against Galatasaray in the last round. They might, but PSG are the defending champions. And it did look, I mean, the champions of France against the champions of England last week in Paris, and it just looked like, oh my goodness me, look, there's class and there's no class at all. But Anfield, European nights, you never know what happens.
OK, well, everything crossed. Have you got some ponytail news?
Well, no, I was just looking at the still that is on the back page of the Times today, and it definitely... And it just looks like such a grab because it's pulling all of the hair back. I mean, it's quite a picture, isn't it? So I've got nothing else to add to your conversation. It was very erudite, and I think that you covered every single base. So I was just adding my little voice of affirmation there. I just don't like it as a style, Jane.
I mean, if you wanted to pull Erling Haaland's hair, the Manchester City striker, he has a sort of little top knot, and he has some hair just loose down to his shoulders.
But he's shaved at the sides, isn't he? Before it goes up. It's too complicated.
I think to tug on his ponytail, we'd need a stepladder, wouldn't we, realistically? So that's not going to be happening. But thank you. That covered a lot of ground, considering we were meant to be talking, in theory, about sport. Vassos, thank you very much. More from Vassos, our sports guy, tomorrow at around the same time.
Coming up, Tom Bradby on his new thriller, Red Scorpion. He is live in the studio. It is 3:31. Let's get a check on the latest news headlines first with James Kitchen.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you, Bea. Good afternoon. The International Monetary Fund says both the war in the Middle East and weak growth late last year are to blame for downgrading Britain's economic prospects. It's predicted the UK economy will grow by just 0.8% this year. At least two ships, including a Chinese-linked tanker, have crossed the Strait of Hormuz, challenging a US blockade. Beijing has condemned the American move as dangerous and irresponsible, warning it will only exacerbate tensions. The former head of NATO says Sir Keir Starmer is not willing to make the necessary investment in defence. Lord Robertson warns Britain's leaders are putting the country in peril. In a speech later, he'll accuse non-military experts in the Treasury of vandalism, and also take aim at what he calls the ever-expanding welfare budget. Pollster and UK director at More in Common, Luke Trill, says the slow response to the Iran conflict has hit home amongst voters.
It has a bigger impact than just on perceptions of defence. It goes to the sort of heart of Britain's national psyche, this sense of we can't defend ourselves. You know, there's a nostalgia for an era when the Navy, the Royal Navy, was the most powerful maritime force.
Richard Phillipson's ordered the equality regulator to tone down its guidance over single-sex spaces before she presents it to Parliament. The Women and Equalities Minister hasn't yet published the new code, a year after a Supreme Court ruling defined gender as relating to biological sex. The boss of South East Water, David Hinton, has turned down his £115,000 bonus. It's after the company admitted that leaving thousands of homes without water was untenable and a failure. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
In a world of noise and uncertainty, IG is the investment platform that backs you. Take our flexible stocks ISA, which gives you the freedom to withdraw funds anytime and replace them in the same tax year, all without losing your £20,000 tax-free allowance. And if that's not enough, pay no commission on your stocks, shares and ETFs when you invest with IG. IG. Trade. Invest. Progress. Your capital's at risk. Other fees may apply. Tax treatment depends on individual circumstances and is subject to change.
AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. That's why it's no surprise that more than 85% of the Fortune 500 use the ServiceNow AI platform. While other platforms duct tape tools together, ServiceNow seamlessly unifies people, data, workflows and AI, connecting every corner of your business. And with AI agents working together autonomously, anyone in any department can focus on the work that matters most. Learn how ServiceNow puts AI to work for people at servicenow.co.uk.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
It's 26 minutes to four. There are very few journalistic beats that Tom Bradby hasn't been on. For ITN, he's covered Ireland and Asia. He's been its political correspondent, UK editor, and also tackled the royal paddock, asking that question of Meghan, are you all right, when she and Harry were on their first tour to Africa after the birth of their son. Probably more on that in a moment. But Tom's latest spy thriller takes the reader on a journey through the underworld of Colombia. In Red Scorpion, the drug barons of South America are vying for your attention as the reader amongst the wilds of Wandsworth Common, a place where his heroine, Dr. Laura Strong, hails from, Earlsfield to be precise, and a place she ultimately hopes to return to in one piece, not least to make sure that her brother is taken care of. We meet her as she's struggling to look after him. He is an adult with special needs, as well as power through her job in A&E on an endless series of night shifts. Everything changes when she meets Raphael, a widower who turns up in that A&E department with his young son one night. He appears to be a South American coffee magnate whose offer of a job could change her life. Dot, 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 dot. The plot thickens. Hello, Tom.
Hello. It's lovely to be back with you.
It's very nice to see you. Tell us a bit more about your heroine, Dr. Laura, because we meet her when she's exhausted by her night shifts. Did you play on your own experience of insomnia in order to convey to the reader the true horror of only 3 hours sleep before a big day?
I did a bit, and two of my best friends, certainly from my school days, run intensive care units. I always say that's nothing to me, but like they do. And I sort of spend a lot of time talking to them about the sort of stresses and strains of their job. So I wanted to create someone who's under incredible pressure at work and is a great doctor, but is also under incredible pressure at home. Her parents have died. She's got a much-loved disabled younger brother she has to care for, and she's really, really struggling financially and in every other way to keep herself afloat. And I think not sleeping does put you under... I mean, many people listening to this will feel all too familiar, but when you don't sleep, things do get out of perspective quite quickly. It is just harder and harder to keep yourself on a level. So she gets this offer, and it seems to be the answer to all her problems. And of course, it's more complicated than that, because he turns out to be the reluctant heir to South America's biggest drugs cartel.
Yes. So there's something of the Sopranos going down, there's something of the Godfather going down. I mean, it's this idea of kind of an evil person who's actually managed to achieve a lifestyle that we also dream of too. The riches and the beautiful houses and all of that spread around the world. But underneath it is just nastiness, isn't it? Nastiness.
Yes, the kind of original idea of that side of it came... I've got a very good friend from university, a guy called Jerry McDermott, who has surely what must be one of the most dangerous jobs in journalism. He runs an organisation called Insight Crime, which investigates organised crime in Latin America, and he lives in Medellin. And it's a very, very difficult job. He's brilliant at it. And the idea came out of conversations with him, really, and he talks about this group called the Invisibles, which are the new generation of cartel bosses who've come a long way from Pablo Escobar, and they hide their illicit activities behind multiple layers of legitimate businesses, because of course as they've got richer they've bought into many legitimate businesses, and they often send their children abroad to be educated. And that's what I was really interested, the idea of the sort of next generation, educated in England, went to Oxford, just to all intents and purposes completely legitimate, but gets and is very reluctant but gets dragged inexorably back
into something that is absolutely without morals.
Horrific, yeah. And you know, he had a very traumatic incident as a child, which, you know, and I hope everyone will read it, so I won't spoil it, but that he just wants to run as far away from it as he possibly can. But, you know, he's a former soldier, was in the British Army, was in the SAS. He's the man who knows how to look after himself. So he's capable of, and when he goes to his sister's wedding and his father drops dead, or, you know, was it an accident, was it murder, he finds himself literally trapped and trying to get out. And of course, as a soldier, he knows how to take command of something, but the only way he appears to be able to get out with the doctor beside him is to take command of his father's organisation, and that, of course, drags him in.
I thought it was very interesting to read the character of Laura's brother. Will you tell us a little bit about him?
Well, I researched a lot, as far as I could, kind of people who are in Laura's situation who are caring for someone. And, of course, invariably there's a sort of absolute deep well of love in that circumstance. But, again, many people listening may relate to the fact that it's also a lot of pressure. And I think that was the sort of point I was interested in. And Laura's parents are dead, so the responsibility is hers. And of course, it's a joyful responsibility in lots of ways. But, you know, she's struggling to keep afloat financially. And of course, as we all know, the state doesn't give the kind of support to many people in these circumstances that people would like and people feel they need. And I mean, on, you know, my day job on News at 10, we're reporting these stories day in, day out. And that, I guess, is one of the things that drew me to it.
Do you travel to the places that you're writing about? Have you been to both Medellin and Earlsfield?
I have been. I used to live in Earlsfield. And that walk up to the Common was a very familiar one when our kids were small. Yes, I have been to Earlsfield. I have also been to Medellin, and I went to stay with my friend Jerry, and we had a very careful look around. And that's obviously one of the joys of writing a novel. I, you know, Claude, my wife, has always been a very significant part of my writing. She's kind of my partner, and we, in life, as in work as well as in life, and we discuss everything, character development, story development, and so it's a brilliant thing to go and do together.
The joy, I would imagine, one of the joys of being a writer is that you can choose the ending to your story, and you can choose redemption, you can choose to take the reader on a very dark journey and then make it all good at the end. And of course, in your day job at the moment, that's exactly what you can't do. We can't do it either, and the viewer at home can't do that with the news. And I wonder where your head is in terms of being a journalist with everything that's going on in the world around us now.
Well, in one sense, people who are watching or listening to this do have the opportunity to switch it off. And that's something we all don't.
Don't switch off.
Yeah, don't switch off. Yeah, just
don't do that now.
Well, part of the thing is, I understand that desire sometimes. And I find it that I do, you know, my mental health's very, you know, as you know, and we've discussed on your podcast previously, I sort of had a fairly public breakdown and went through the recovery process and got myself straightened out by Britain's scariest psychiatrist and have been basically very well since. But, you know, occasionally I do feel I have to kind of battle off a bit of, not depression exactly, but it's kind of, it's easy to get a bit low about it sometimes. And I think that that has probably most to do with the fact that I've been with ITN. I met the ITN, new ITN trainees not very long ago, and they're honestly charming, brilliant, bright. And I said, when I walked in, you know, this reminds me that when I walked in here as a trainee 36 years ago, and for a moment they looked at me like I was clinically insane before they just sort of recover themselves and like, oh, great, yes, gosh, still here after 36 years, you know, all the rest of it. But, you know, I've been there a long time, and you'll remember this. Like, in the first part of our careers, didn't you feel like, yeah, there were some terrible things happening in the world, but the world was basically going in a good direction? You know, the Iron Curtain fell, the Berlin Wall came down, Nelson Mandela got released. You felt like the world was going in a good direction. And now it's a bit hard to feel that. I feel like democracy's under threat, people are trying to undermine it. And so we all have to be vigilant. So what I always say to people is, like, please don't switch off the news, because it really, really matters. And we need you to be engaged. And, you know, we're doing our best. I'm sure a lot of people are annoyed very often at the way we all do our jobs. But we're doing our best to try and give you good information. And when you look to America, at what happens when people don't have reliable information, this, you know, you can see what happens.
Yeah. And what do you think about our ability to hand down to the next generation the simple notion that balanced news counts? Because actually the programme that you do, Anchoring News at 10, the show that we do here, and many of the other programmes that Jane and I have both worked on, you can completely understand why the younger generation won't want that. They're long-form programmes. They attempt to display news in hopefully a balanced way. The way that the younger generation is getting its news on TikTok and on social media, fast, furious, tiny, short, opinionated, those are two very, very different ways of dealing with the same material.
That's true, although your podcast, I don't know what the age profile would be, but I would imagine you've probably got quite a lot of young listeners. And I noticed with a lot of the very long-form podcasts and a lot of the long-form programmes on YouTube, you do get quite significant numbers of younger viewers. And of course, like every news organization, we're putting a lot of our stuff up on YouTube now. And sometimes it's quite surprising the number of young viewers we have. So I think young people want good information. And I just think we've all got to continue, you know, none of us are perfect. We don't always get everything right. And we should be the first to acknowledge that. I certainly would be. But hopefully we're doing our best. And, you know, I think younger people do want good information, and it's really, really important that they get it. I mean, I don't know how often you go to America, but I just find it absolutely startling when I'm there. It's like you switch on Fox News and then CNN. I mean, it's just different universes. They're not even vaguely talking about the same facts. And I find that terrifying.
Would you choose news again if you were starting out in 2026?
Yeah.
Would you?
Yeah. I'm kind of addicted to knowing about what's going on in the world. I do try to switch off from time to time, but I'm not especially good at it. You know, I don't know about how you find it, but like it's always there, it's always on your phone, and I really have to be quite disciplined to myself, like, put your phone down, mate, put it over there, go and sit in the garden in the sunshine and think about nothing for a while. And it's hard to think about nothing, you know, it's hard. I mean, I have always carried lots of stories, as we were talking about at the start, in my head, so they're always swirling around. But even when one isn't, it's tempting to pick up your phone and go on X or whatever, you know, and check something out. What's the latest? Who said what? What's the latest crazy thing that's happened? And you just do have to, I find I have to be very disciplined to switch it off. But no, I wouldn't change anything. I've loved my career. It's been the greatest privilege ever. And I still love it. I still go in there, and I'm doing news at 10, 11 years. And I just love it. You know, as the 10 o'clock approaches and you're thinking about how you're going to frame the news of that day, try and make sense of it to people. I mean, sometimes, you know, even the last 24, 36 hours, you know, Trump posts himself as Jesus Christ and then insults the Pope and then takes the post down.
Oh, no, you do have to pinch yourself, don't you?
You do.
Am I dreaming this?
Yeah.
It is our reality.
Tweeting half the night, and you're just like, well, how am I going to make sense of that? And, you know, on the war in Iran, you know, sometimes totally different, contradictory things are said in the same day, and you've got to try and make sense of that. But that's an interesting challenge, and I still love it.
We know you for your many roles at ITN, but particularly being royal correspondent for a while, because you seem to be very, very much in that camp. Can you say much about your relationship with the royals now? Did it cease when you stopped being royal correspondent?
What I've sort of discovered on this subject is that very, very boringly, and I feel like such a killjoy saying it, but I've worked out that the only way I can get through life without being sort of quoted and creating a headline is to sort of just take a vow of silence about it. And it's very boring, and I understand why I always get asked about it, but I sort of feel like if I stick to my vow of silence for life, eventually, it will go away is a question. And I've tried every other version of it. I've tried, like, in, you know, and as a journalist, you always want to engage.
Yes,
I know
it's
where you're
not going away.
Yeah. Well, I know why you ask, and I'm a journalist, and I always feel bad about it. But it just derails everything if I go on the record about it, and it derails whatever I'm trying to talk about, and it overshadows it, and it creates headlines, and it causes problems for me, and I don't think it helps them. So
no, I completely understand that. Allow me just one more question.
Yeah, sure.
You can just choose to completely not answer it, and Jane will pick up and we'll talk about something else. But I did wonder, so when you asked Meghan that question, it was such a good journalistic question to ask somebody. They were on tour, they were in Africa, she had had a baby, she was out there trying to do those, you know, two things, and you said, are you okay? And she basically said, I'm really glad that somebody asked me that, because I'm just not sure I am. In that moment, you couldn't possibly have foreseen where we are now in terms of how many, many people view Meghan. But what did you think when she answered you so honestly?
I mean, again, it's a sort of one of those things that even if you just say word for word what you've said before, it'll create a headline. But I think I've been on the record before as saying, I don't, you know, would I have asked the question that way if I hadn't had my own mental health issues? And that's the sort of territory I thought we would be in with the answer. So, like, I wasn't particularly surprised by the answer, but I was very careful about... I think if that's what you anticipate may be the issue, you don't want to go in with kind of clawed feet saying, just asking a question. You know, I guess I was trying to ask an open question. Some people thought it was a good question. Some people criticized me for it. But I think sometimes if you really want to get someone to talk, you have to ask an open question rather than a closed question.
I thought that was a great question.
That was my sort of thinking behind it, I think.
Yeah. Would you ever be tempted to slightly disguise a character within one of your novels, but be able to tell us a little bit more about your time? When
keep going, Fee. She's going to get that.
Fee, can I say that is the best way of reframing this subject I've ever encountered.
You're a trier.
I think the answer to that would be no.
Okay.
I'm really concerned, and maybe you can help me, Tom, that when Donald Trump goes, because he won't be there forever, I'm horrified to admit, I think I'm going to miss him. I worry about that. And I said to Fee earlier, oh, we haven't heard from Donald Trump today. And there's a part of me that I want to hear from him. I want him to do something offensive, say something idiotic, post something despicable. What does that say about me, and what does that say about us and the future of news?
I'll tell you what, exactly. I mean, in a way, it's a sort of... It's kind of both a fun and a serious question, isn't it? I mean, like, I was just reading a copy of today's Times again outside the studio here, and of course it's full of his tweeting at 2:38 and 2:54 in the morning.
Which should be really concerning.
Yeah, and at 4 in the morning, and to go back to the earlier bit of the conversation, I'm sort of acutely familiar with what happens to you when you're not sleeping and how things change pretty. So I think we've got every reason to be sort of very worried about that. And I kind of know what you mean, because every day he does something, you know, picking a fight with the Pope, as I said, posting a picture of himself as depicting himself as Jesus. I mean, these are things you just could never have imagined an American president doing before. And now they're happening daily, hourly, sometimes minutely. And when I'm doing the run-up to news at 10, you know, it's sort of between 3 p.m. and 5 p.m. Quite often that's when Donald Trump is giving a press conference or a speech, and so we're listening to it. And I mean, the weave is getting pretty weaveful, if that's a phrase, which it isn't. You know, sometimes he's contradicting in one paragraph what he said in the last paragraph and all the rest of it. But the serious bit of your question, which I think is kind of an interesting thing, is when I started doing news at 10, 11 years ago, in the days when you still went and maybe checked out some responses on Twitter, I found that, you know, I was doing it in a different style and some people liked it and some people didn't. And there was quite a lot of all caps, angry, you know, why can't you just read the news, ! And I thought, well, fine, fair enough. You don't like it. That's absolutely fine. But then about 8 months later, I realized that some of the same people were still writing the same stuff every day. And I'm like, why are you still watching? And then I finally realized, well, because they're angry. And anger is a very stimulating emotion. Makes you feel, you know, if maybe your life isn't, I don't want to say boring, but like it's not full of a lot of being angry and that sense of kind of moral rush you get of, well, I'm better than him. I know what he's doing is wrong and I'm connecting up with other people who agree with me. I mean, that's very stimulating, I think.
Do the ratings go up when it's a big Trump day? If you're doing the news at 10 and Trump's done
No? No. I mean, the ratings have always been dominated most by what programme is on before. You have a big audience before, you tend to have a bigger audience, smaller. I mean, and logic beyond that, I've spent 11 years trying to find a logic beyond that and I'm really got there. No. I think we just try to do the best programme we can and not be too worried about.
And those figures of Amal Rajan comes into mind, somebody who's got to the very top of BBC News and Current Affairs, but has decided that, in a way, and I'm not getting at him here, that it's not quite enough, that he wants to be able to do his own thing, perhaps express himself more freely, because to be fair to people at the BBC, they're not allowed to. I mean, you can be you have a slightly different way of doing the bulletin on ITN, don't you? That, as you say, not everybody likes. Are you less frustrated than some BBC figures?
Yeah, I think I have a little bit more elbow room to maybe, I don't think have opinions, but certainly to sort of have, you know, allow a bit more personality, show, or have a bit more kind of, I would call it human reaction. And in, like, if you don't like that, you don't watch. I mean, probably maybe you still are watching and shouting at me, but, you know, probably you're not watching. And I think ITV have always been very good to me. I still really love the job and I love working there. And I've the last 5 or 6, 7 years, I've really sort of tried to concentrate. I've got this TV drama of my novel Secret Service coming out on Monday, the 27th of April, which is like a big thing for me. It's like a 5-part drama I've spent a long time working on. And so I've tried to sort of turn my writing into a kind of really more logical career alongside my broadcasting, where I sort of write a novel and then turn each one of my novels into a film or a TV drama. And that's getting very, very full. So I don't really want or have time to sort of think about anything other than keeping both those horses going. And I totally understand why Amal would do what he's doing, and I think he may not be the last, and he hasn't been the first. You know, Emily and John Sopel and people went out the door.
So did we.
Well, so did you, yeah.
I think Tom was going to get round to that.
Yeah. Well, you were the first, really, out the door, weren't you?
Not quite. I don't think we were.
You were the first big departure of the new...
No, we went just after Emily Maitlis and John Sopel had gone. Yeah, but it's kind of you. It's kind of you to even think that, Tom.
Yeah. Freedom, was that what it's about? Because you...
Yes, I mean, I think we felt that the horizon here was more exciting for us than the horizon at the BBC. I never want to speak for my colleague here, and she's thrown me quite a stern look. So I'm going to return to the book, Tom, and ask you a final question about that. A lot of your books are standalone, aren't they? And they span all kinds of different places and points in history, actually. And I did wonder, I don't want to give away the ending here at all, but I mean, let's just say that Dr. Laura is a stayer, and I wondered whether there is a bit of a future for her in your imagination.
I don't know. The TV drama that I was mentioning, this character Kate Henson, who's played by Gemma Arterton in the TV show, which sometimes you do a TV, you know, drama or film and you've got no idea how it's going to turn out, and I just so love the way that's turned out, and she's so fantastic in it, and there are three books, so I'm kind of obviously very hopeful that's going to go on. Laura Strong, I also really love her as a character. I think she's I really did love writing her. I decided that I would try to move that to film, so I saw the film rights, and I've actually just delivered the first version of the film version of the script, and it would be a much bigger, it would have to be a sort of Hollywood film because it's a sort of $50 million film. So we did a deal with a Hollywood company, and so we're sort of on that road. And I think as I get on that road, and I think part of their thinking is there a franchise here? So I think it's something I'm going to have to devote some time. I'm writing another book now as well, just to give myself plenty to be doing. So It's at the back of my mind to think about it.
Right. We are really going to put Wandsworth Common and Earlsfield on the map, Tom. I think that's fantastic. Absolutely fantastic.
I think you've always got to have Wandsworth Common on the map.
This comes in from a man who says, I've recently been reading Tom Bradby's novel Secret Service, Double Agent and Triple Cross. Loved them. So well written. Held me from the first page. Well, I should warn you, Anne, the first page in Red Scorpion is quite gory, actually, isn't it? I did read it and go, okay, hold on tight.
hold on tight. Yeah,
it's not that level of gore all the way through.
No,
that's all I'd say.
That's true.
It's been lovely to see you. Thank you very much.
It's always lovely to come in. One of the highlights of this kind of thing. So thanks for inviting me.
Thank you. Goodbye. yes, thank you, Tom. Yeah. And it looks as though Trump has woken up. So more details with John Pienaar between 4 o'clock and seven. 3 minutes to four now.
Hugo Rifkind on Times Radio with Elevon. Join Hugo every Monday to Thursday morning from 10 as he takes a sometimes serious and sometimes satirical look at the day's news, politics and culture. Covering all the major stories making the headlines with in-depth analysis and exclusive interviews. Hugo Rifkind on Times Radio with Elevon. We support all payments for your business. Make one decision today. Visit elevon.co.uk.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
There is a land steeped in ancient history, myth and legend, where the views are wild, the welcomes are warm, and the magic is real. This spring, start your own story in Scotland. From wild mountain ranges to bustling cities, witness Scotland bloom into life this spring. Explore its dramatic landscapes and uncover our ancient Celtic roots. Experience vast lochs, majestic glens and lofty mountains, all easily accessible from our many vibrant cities and towns. Scotland is the perfect place to find yourself. Whether you're looking for scenic hikes or a stay in a cosy cottage, there's something for every type of traveller in Scotland. And with an exciting range of festivals and sporting and cultural events to enjoy, spring is the perfect time to plan your escape. Write your own Scottish story this spring. Start your adventure at visitscotland.com/spring.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Tom Bradby was our very welcome guest this afternoon. His book is called Red Scorpion, and it's out now. And you don't have to have read the others to enjoy that one, do you?
No, not at all. This is a standalone one. So, Anne, get yourself a copy and head on in there.
Yeah, you'll enjoy it. The guest tomorrow afternoon is the fantastic actress Joanna Scanlon. She's talking about an audiobook she's recorded, or an audio monologue, really. It's very creepy. It's called Mercy. And she's also adorning Channel 5 all this week in a rather spooky thriller called Missed Call. It was made in the south of France, and Joanna, I've already recorded the interview, was telling me it was really hot, unlike those Channel 5 dramas that pretend to be in the summer. Everybody's got an anorak on, you can tell. This was actually really hot. Anyway, so Joanna Scanlon tomorrow, our producer today, Hannah Quinn, technical operator, Ryan Boyden. And thank you very much for listening. John Pienaar is next with Drive.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio. The voice of the times.
Thank you, Fee. Thank you, Jane. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar. This is Times Radio Drive, and here are the headlines. The IMF says the UK economy faces the biggest hit from the Iran war than any other G7 nation. And the US blockade of Hormuz Strait continues. At least two ships, including a Chinese-linked tanker, have passed through that crucial waterway. And coming up, Times Defence Editor Larissa Brown will be with me looking at the former NATO boss's criticism of the government's lack of defence spending. And Admiral Lord West, former First Sea Lord, will be here giving his view too. And as Israel and Lebanese representatives meet for negotiations in Washington, D.C., could the talks actually achieve anything, considering that Hezbollah has already said it won't abide by any agreements that are made?
This is Times Radio.
And here's the news with James Kitchen.
Thank you, John. Good afternoon. New forecasts reveal Britain will sustain the largest hit to growth from the Middle East war and suffer the joint highest inflation in the G7. The International Monetary Fund warns stagflation is set to plague the UK economy yet again. The IMF's research director, Pierre-Olivier Gonachat, said the Iran conflict threatened to throw the world economy off course.
The closing of the Strait of Hormuz and serious damage to critical energy facilities in the Middle East raised the prospect of a major energy crisis should a durable solution not be found soon. Oil and gas prices have increased sharply, and so have the prices of diesel and jet fuel, fertilizer, aluminium and helium.
The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has vowed to keep inflation and interest rates in line. Meanwhile, Donald Trump has again attacked Britain over its energy policies. In a fresh post on Truth Social, the US president called on the UK to drill baby drill in the North Sea, saying Aberdeen should be booming. At least two ships, including a Chinese-linked tanker, have crossed the Strait of Hormuz, challenging a US blockade. Beijing has condemned the American move as dangerous and irresponsible, warning it will only exacerbate tensions. The US Vice President J.D. Vance has accused Iran of economic terrorism, saying two can play at that game after the regime closed the shipping lane. Farzan Nedimi is senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Speaking to Times Radio, he said Tehran has little room for manoeuvrability.
The doors are still open. I think the contacts are still on. And at some level, the discussions will continue. It could or could not be another round of negotiations anytime soon. But I think that at the end of the day, the Iranian regime will not show any willingness or ability to show the flexibility that the U.S. administration desires.
The Prime Minister and the Chancellor are being accused of complacency on defence by the author of the government's own review. In a speech later, the former NATO chief, Lord Robertson, will warn the UK's underprepared and not safe, adding Britain's national security is in peril. Funding for the Defence Investment Plan appears to be holding up its release. The Times' former defence editor, Michael Evans, says Keir Starmer is facing pressure from his own MPs to spend money elsewhere.
The trouble is this argument is buried in politics, and the Labour backbenchers who are adamant that the welfare budget cannot be touched, in fact, should be increased. This is the sort of opposition which Number 10 is facing every day. And this is why Starmer has not been able, as promised, to start switching things round and spend a lot more on defence.
Bridget Phillipson's ordered the equality regulator to tone down its guidance over single-sex spaces and make it more inclusive before she presents it to Parliament. The Women and Equalities Minister hasn't yet published the long-delayed new code of practice. A Supreme Court ruling in April last year defined gender as relating to biological sex. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker. John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive with ServiceNow.
Hello and welcome to Drive on Times Radio with me, John Pienaar. Thanks for your company. Now, Keir Starmer is being accused again today of idly, complacently failing to beef up Britain's defences in the face of Vladimir Putin's Russian war machine and President Trump's rejection of NATO. The fact that the latest warning comes from a former NATO Secretary General and Defence Secretary makes the accusation cut deeply. Lord Robertson, George Robertson, when he was a loyal and respected Labour MP, will use a speech later this evening to call the government's complacency on defence spending corrosive. But the implication of the attack cuts more deeply still. It's that Keir Starmer, a Prime Minister already under enormous political pressure, is guilty of more than complacency, that he's giving way to fear. Fear of confronting MPs on his own side and others who'll oppose the spending cuts needed to provide more money for defence, and fear of forcing the country to face a harsh reality. The fact that Britain's military strength has dangerously wasted away under successive governments, and it now falls to Starmer's administration to take the long overdue decisions which will surely be painful and unpopular. So will the Prime Minister rise to this challenge? And just how great is the danger? I'll get the views of the former head of the Royal Navy live on the programme in just a moment. And do tell me what you are thinking. Send me a text, 87222, start with the word Times, or a tweet to @TimesRadio. So, let's then welcome to the programme Lord West, the former First Sea Lord and head of the Royal Navy and former Security Minister in Gordon Brown's Labour government. Hello to you, Lord West.
Good afternoon.
Good to have you here. So George Robertson, then, is criticising and means to criticise the government's failure to act quickly to strengthen the British military in very remarkably strong terms. Complacency, which is corrosive. He says too much money is being devoted to welfare and not enough for defence. He says the Treasury is guilty of vandalism and the Prime Minister is at fault for not making necessary investment. Lord West, is Lord Robertson right about that? Is he also right to speak out like this?
I think he is, and it's very surprising. George Robertson is a very steady, solid Labour supporter. He was an ex-minister, you know, he headed up NATO. He's not someone who goes and speaks passionately about things in this sort of way unless he feels very, very strongly. And, of course, he produced the SDR. All the recommendations were taken by the government. And I think he believes that since then, nothing really has happened. And he's very upset about the defence investment plan not having been brought forward. He sees all his good work in the SDR just going to waste. And I fear that he's absolutely right. There's no doubt that Starmer spoke very well in Munich, where he said, you know, to the other NATO nations, European NATO nations, we've got to spend more money, we're all going to do this. We in the UK will bring forward our spending and go up to 3.5% by the end of this government.
Yeah.
And he came back and I'm sure told the Chancellor to do that. And reading between the lines, I don't know exactly what happened, it looks as though the Chancellor said, you must be joking, I'm not going to do it. Well, you know, he is the Prime Minister, he's in charge, and I think more than he would like. Whether he's been a success or not as a Prime Minister will actually relate to this. I mean, in Germany, for example, huge increase in defence spending, which they've tied to regenerating all of their industries, all their car industries, because they're not making the sales. And so defence is going to cover the gap and they're going to start producing a lot of material that way. Now, we could do something like that. And I fear that Starmer is not really grabbing it and running with it.
Yeah, I guess we can assume, Lord West, that the Prime Minister and those at number 10 must be wishing that George Robertson had made his obviously very strong feelings clear in private, behind closed doors.
I think that's absolutely right. But to me, it indicates that he's very, very...